From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. School districts, teachers, and families around the country are in flux today. With the pandemic raging out of control, Kentucky's governor has closed the state's classrooms for in-person learning starting Monday.
And in New York City, home to the country's largest public school system, more than a million students are moving to online-only learning today as cases also surge there. NYC is one of the first major metropolitan areas in the country to reopen schools to in-person classes back in the fall. And up until today, about 300,000 students had been attending. Let's bring in WNYC's Jessica Gould, who covers education in New York. And Jessica, start by telling us, how big of a blow is this to families who have been sending their kids to classes?
Keep in mind, that's only about a little more than a quarter of this enormous school system of almost a million students. So 3/4 of families had already opted to be fully remote. The rest were going in person a few days a week if their schools could accommodate them in small cohorts with lots of masks and testing. You know, the mayor really trumpeted this opening of schools as a triumph for the city, as it was coming back from the worst days of the epidemic in the spring. And he was incredibly committed to reopening schools for students, saying that remote learning just can't, you know, give kids what in-person instruction can. So for many families, this is a huge blow. They have to figure out childcare. They have to make sure they have devices. There are still some 60,000 device requests outstanding that need to be filled for low-income students. It's a major change for kids who've weathered so much change so far.
Sure. Well, you mentioned Mayor de Blasio's commitment to opening schools. There had been some tension between he and Governor Cuomo. Cuomo actually said on Tuesday that the city has only about 2.9% when it comes to the average positive 7-day results. And has de Blasio weighed in on the school closure announcement at all?
Well, the state and the city have different numbers for how they calculate this. And the city's numbers are 3%, which was this threshold that the mayor promised to the teachers' union and to parents that if infections citywide, the positivity rate went over 3%, that he would shutter the schools. As there was a huge backlash from parents about this in the past week when we were approaching this threshold and it seemed clear we were going to have to close, Governor Cuomo, who often steps in, some might say steps on Mayor de Blasio and reverses his decisions, started raising questions about this threshold and said, you know, maybe we should be looking at the positivity rates within schools, which are much lower. So far, he has said, you know, within certain parameters that the state set, the city has the discretion to close its schools. And so far, that's what they're doing. Now, the mayor and the governor are in discussion with the unions about how to reopen and what standards they would set for reopening.
Do these restrictions also apply to private schools in New York?
No. And, you know, New York City has one of the most segregated, some say the most segregated school systems in the country. Private schools, charter schools, religious schools fall under the state's jurisdiction for this rather than the city's. So the city public schools are now all closed, where kids who are in private school are able to go to school in person some 5 days a week. So many point out that that's just, you know, creating more inequity in an already inequitable system.
That's Jessica Gould. She covers education for WNYC. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
And it's not just schools. The pandemic is putting such a strain on hospitals that nurses are reaching a breaking point. Almost 800 nurses at the St. Mary Medical Center in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, went on strike this week to protest what they describe as unsafe staffing levels. Joining us now is Jim Gentile. He's a nurse at St. Mary Medical Center and a member of the Pennsylvania Association of Staff Nurses and Allied Professionals. Jim, thanks for making time for us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And what are the conditions inside the hospital that have led you to walk out?
So we have been a union for over a year, about 14 months, and we started negotiations on a contract this time last year. COVID hit and we suspended our contract negotiations. And then when our numbers went down appreciably, the end of June, beginning of July, we urged them to get back to the bargaining table so we can get a contract. All summer long, they made no movement. Our COVID numbers doubled in the last 2 weeks, and they've still made no movement on our contract. And we said to them, this is urgent now. We've been telling you for 3 years we need more nurses, and we're telling you now it's critical. I mean, we're in the uptick, and we need nurses desperately.
How short-staffed are you? And when you're facing a staffing shortage, how does it affect the quality of care that patients are getting in the pandemic?
Every patient that comes into the hospital deserves to have a nurse. So if the ratios, instead of one nurse to four patients or one nurse to six or seven patients, last weekend it was one nurse to eight patients in one unit. When one person starts to get sick, and we call a crash, when their condition deteriorates rapidly, you have to be with that patient. And you could be with that patient up to 2 hours. Well, during those 2 hours, the other six patients are not getting any attention. You know, when you're doing that, the other ones can crash too, and no one's there for them. So when you spread us so thin, there's no way we can have eyes on all of those patients at the same time.
Look, I understand you must be exhausted. The work you're describing sounds really difficult. But why are you striking now when the virus is surging across the country and there are people in the hospital who are relying on you now more than ever, but you're not there?
Right. So we're striking now because it hasn't hit critical yet. And we know it's going to hit critical. We know the numbers are probably going to double in the next 2 weeks. And that's why we're saying we need staff now.
Jim, the ratios you've described already sound really bad, though. So, I mean, do you think that your strike would put patients' lives in danger?
No, they did not. So what happened is the doctors themselves have said, we're not going to bring our electives in here right now during this strike. They've brought in 185 nurses. We don't know. Have these nurses been quarantined? Have these nurses been tested? We were asking for testing for ourselves, and they said only if you have symptoms. So some of our nurses in the last 2 weeks have become COVID positive, and they're out. And we are in the same break room eating lunch. Of course, we're 6 feet apart without our masks on, but we asked to be tested just because we were at high risk. And they said only if you have symptoms. So now they bring in 185 nurses to replace us. And we're like, they're from all over the country. They've had 5 days notice to get here. I'm sure they're not quarantined. And I don't know if they've been tested.
Trinity Health System, the owner of your hospital, furloughed 12% of its staff earlier this year, cut executive pay as well. Is it realistic to expect in these very difficult times for hospitals that they can afford to bring on new nurses?
Well, they can afford to bring in 185 replacement nurses at $110 an hour per nurse, putting them up for lodging and food and transportation. So if they can afford to do that, they can certainly afford to compensate the nurses and bring more nurses in, especially at this time.
When do you think you'll be going back to work?
Sunday morning, I hope.
When you do go back, how will you prepare yourself for the long weeks and months ahead in this winter? It's going to be tough, as you say.
Yeah, it's tough. Listen, we're the ones who wore the PPE for 12 hours straight until there was ridges on our faces. We know what it's going to take, and we're prepared for that. We do all have a little bit of PTSD. I can do it without equipment. I can do it without the comforts. But I need extra hands. When I'm in one room, all gowned and gloved, and helping a patient prone them because their lungs are doing so crappy and they're crashing, the person next to them, the same things happen to them, and I can't be in two rooms at one time. We need, and this has happened. This is a real-life story. I was on night shift in the spring, and it sounds bizarre, but I've wrapped and done more post-mortem care on bodies in 2 months than I did in 25 years of nursing. And we can't let that happen again. All right, I know some people are going to die because of their comorbidities, their age, etc. But they shouldn't be dying alone.
You know, I'm sure you've seen the news. We've gotten some pretty good headlines about a vaccine from both Moderna and Pfizer recently. Their vaccines appear to be, though not approved, 95% effective. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel here with this crisis?
So absolutely. A couple of things are going for us in this as we head towards this spike again. We now know some of the things that we need to do early on that will prevent the mortality that we saw in the spring. We have the PPE, finally. So we're really hopeful, and these vaccines are right around the corner, so we're really hopeful. But there's still going to be many people that die that don't need to die because there's not enough nurses to prone them, to give them the breathing treatments, to get them the nourishment they need. You know, you need people in there taking care of these extremely sick people, because by the time they get to the hospital, they are really sick.
Jim Gentile, a nurse at St. Mary's Medical Center in Pennsylvania, on strike over the working conditions at that hospital. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
We did ask the hospital for a comment. A spokesperson for Trinity Health says it is laser-focused on caring for patients during the pandemic and that the replacement nurses working now are experienced, skilled, and meet all COVID-related safety requirements. The spokesperson went on to say that Trinity Health is committed to negotiating in good faith to reach a fair contract.
Millions of Americans relied on the first wave of coronavirus relief money to pay rent and mortgages, keep their businesses afloat during the pandemic, or just to get by. Now, a number of relief programs are soon to expire, and negotiations over another coronavirus bill in Congress are still stalled. For a deeper look at what benefits are set to expire, we have with us Reed Pickard. She's a business and economy reporter for Bloomberg News, and she's on Skype. Reed, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. So you and your colleague Olivia Rockman wrote about what's soon coming to an end, starting with two federal unemployment programs that are expiring. The first one is for gig and self-employed workers. Can you tell us about both of those?
Yes, of course. So the program for gig and self-employed workers is known as Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, or PUA, and it extended jobless benefits to those not typically eligible, like the self-employed and gig workers. And this has been a real lifeline for a lot of people, because you think about, for instance, people aren't taking as many Ubers. And the Century Foundation actually estimated that 7.3 million of these workers will see their PUA expire the day after Christmas. The other program is known as Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, PEUC, and that is very similar to what we've seen in prior recessions. It's an extension of unemployment insurance payments for up to 13 more weeks once a person has exhausted their regular state unemployment insurance. So in most states, you get 26 weeks of regular jobless benefits. But in other states, such as Florida or North Carolina, you get much fewer. So people have been rolling on to the PEUC program at a different pace depending on, you know, where you live and when you lost your job. In terms of going back to the Century Foundation, they also estimated that 4.6 million workers will see their PEUC benefits prematurely expire on December 26. So that leads us to about roughly 12 million people that are poised to lose their CARES Act unemployment insurance benefits the day after Christmas.
And you've been talking with some of them.
Yeah, I've talked with people who are on PUA and who are just watching the bills stack up and haven't been able to pay their full rent since July. So you add in the eviction moratorium expiring, and some people are really scared about what's going to happen. And then I've also talked to people who have already run through all of these benefits. Who I talked to a woman in North Carolina who ran through. They offer about half the benefits as most states offer. And so she ran through North Carolina's unemployment benefits, and then she ran through PEUC. But now she told me she was looking at $4 in her wallet. And so it's a really tough time for a lot of people.
Let's talk a little bit about that federal moratorium on evictions. It's for qualified renters. We've talked about this quite a bit on the show. That expires December 31st. How does that moratorium work, and who's potentially impacted?
So there's the national moratorium, and then several states have enacted their own suspensions, but just a handful of those state ones extend beyond year end. So this kind of looming deadline is still the December 31st deadline. This one that's particularly we have now is one that was created by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention after the protection that was from the CARES Act expired back in July. So many people haven't been able to pay their full rent in months. So getting evicted is a very real concern. And as one of the women we quoted in the article said, once evicted, where do you find a landlord will take you when you have no income to show. But landlords are also in a really tricky place, especially landlords that have mortgages. So they have their own bills to pay.
Yeah, it's a domino effect. The CARES Act also gave relief to some student loan debt and paused monthly payment requirements. What's happening there?
Right. So student debt is a huge issue, and Americans now have a stunning $1.7 trillion in student debt. Most of that is owed to the federal government, and because it's owed to the federal government, most of it applies for the assistance that you just mentioned. And so the CARES Act suspended payments, lowered interest rates to 0%, and halted the collection on defaulted loans. That CARES Act has already expired, but President Donald Trump authorized the Secretary of Education to extend those protections until year end. But now we're quickly approaching year end.
Congress is divided on relief. What are the options now? Could President-elect Biden take this on and really turn this around quickly when he takes office? Or could President Trump take this action on extending any relief right now?
Joe Biden won't take office until late January, so you're still going to have a gap. But honestly, the picture is looking pretty bleak. I mean, from a Congress perspective, you mentioned they're in a stalemate. And the latest I've heard from my colleagues on the Hill is that Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell remain at odds on the size of another stimulus package. As you mentioned about President Trump, for several of these protections, they were created through executive actions. But as of now, he hasn't outlined a plan to extend these programs and protections again through executive actions.
Reed Pickard is business and economy reporter for Bloomberg News. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, with congressional negotiations deadlocked, some states are trying to step in to offer coronavirus relief. In Colorado, Democratic Governor Jared Polis announced this week that he'll call a special session of the state legislature.
Extraordinary times call for extraordinary actions. I'll be asking the General Assembly to take up critical legislation that will help Colorado families and Colorado small businesses survive these challenging winter months ahead to bridge us to the vaccine.
Let's check in on Colorado with State Senate Majority Leader Steve Finberg, a Democrat of Boulder. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
State Senator Finberg, what are the specifics of the aid you hope to get passed in the special session?
Yeah, well, we're still working on some of the details, but we know that the surge is very bad right now. We're in the worst place that we've been in terms of coronavirus in Colorado, and it's only probably going to get worse before it gets better. So we know that's going to mean more restrictions on businesses, more restrictions on families and what they can do, and we need to step in and provide some assistance. So we're hoping to do direct financial support for small businesses around the state, especially ones that are impacted by capacity limits, so restaurants and bars and gyms and places like that. We're also hoping to provide financial assistance to child care centers because we know that they have financially struggled and many of them are going under, and we actually need more child care capacity. So we need to ensure that we're helping the ones that are struggling but also providing support potentially to stand up more child care centers. And then we're also looking at things like food pantry assistance, utility assistance so people can keep the heat on, and a few other aspects such as housing assistance, rental assistance, and things like that. So we really are prioritizing direct financial assistance to the people that are going to be hurt the most, especially as the surge continues and as the winter months come on and business is less likely to have flexibility to do business outside.
But how are you going to pay for this aid? We read that the budget forecast for the state is not looking good.
That's right. We are definitely in economic hard times for families, for businesses, but also for the state budget. That's right. And we passed a historic budget several months ago during the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, and we had to make some very difficult decisions. We cut billions of dollars from our budget. And luckily, we in some areas cut more than we needed to. And it's a low bar. I mean, it's not like we were massively off track on the budget we passed. But there are parts of the economy are coming back in ways that we weren't totally sure were going to. And so we do have some one-time money from this fiscal year, simply because we passed such a difficult and conservative budget a couple of months ago. So again, it's a low bar. We're still in difficult times economically, but we're going to use some of that one-time money to help people right now.
You know, the governor, as we know, is Democratic. Democrats hold the majority in the legislature. Republican Senate Minority Leader Chris Hulbert said Republicans are ready to negotiate. And he said that, quote, "We hope that Democrats will give the same good faith consideration to legislation that we might propose as we are theirs." What are you expecting Republicans to propose? And would that differ from Democratic proposals? And would you be willing to agree to Republican proposals?
Yes. We've had some conversations with the Republicans over the last several days as we've been putting together the proposals and the ideas for the special session. And we're approaching this in a collaborative manner. Like you said, Democrats controlled both chambers, but also the governor's office. So we could pass something just with Democratic support. But in this time, I think what our country and what our state needs is a coordinated effort, no matter what party you come from, to provide the most help and the most relief to people that are in need right now. So we are very much open to having those conversations with the Republicans, figuring out what of our ideas can be massaged a little bit to be workable for them and hopefully make as many of these policies bipartisan as possible.
That's Colorado State Senate Majority Leader Steve Finberg. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message is brought to you by the New England Innovation Academy, an innovative engine for students in grades 6 through 12, the first middle and high school that prepares innovators to shape the world through human-centered design. Part world school, part incubator, teaching the cultural dexterity and global focus this era demands. To learn more, visit neiacademy.org.
If you need a feel-good story today, we've got one for you. A worker helping set up the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree in New York City found a mysterious stowaway inside the 75-foot Norway spruce, a tiny little owl. Ellen Kalish runs the Ravensbeard Wildlife Center in Saugerties, New York. She's been taking care of the bird. And Ellen, how's that gorgeous little creature doing today?
He's great. He's eating and drinking. He had a bath by himself. He's just been a little joy to rehab.
And I hear you have a name for him.
Yes. We had to call him Rockefeller.
You did. Did you have any other choice, really?
No.
Listen, I guess as the way the story goes, you got a call from the wife of the worker who found the owl in the branches of this tree.
Yeah.
How surprised were you when you got that call?
I never heard anything even remotely like this. I've been doing this for 20 years, and this is the first time we've ever had an owl in a Christmas tree.
Well, I guess there's some question about how he got there. Do you think he hitched a ride down from central New York where the tree was cut down?
We'll never really know, but yes, that's my thought. He could have had a concussion when the tree was cut if he was in it. He could have flown into the tree once it was down as a daytime refuge to sleep. And then got caught when they wrapped the branches tight to the trunk. We don't know for sure, but his condition and the way he looked when he came in seemed to me that he'd been without food for quite a few days.
Hmm. So he needed some help. We hear that little Rockefeller is a saw-whet owl. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
And it is one of the smallest owls out there. How small are we talking? Tell me about what Rockefeller looks like.
He's about 5 inches tall. The males are much smaller than the females. So we know he's a male because we weighed him. He weighs about 2.5 ounces. They range from 2 ounces to 5, depending on the owl. Their wingspan is between 18 and 22 inches, and they're 8 inches long. So he's an itty bitty.
But his eyes, not his eyes.
Oh, no.
Those things are huge.
Yeah, the eyes are very large for collecting moon and starlight, helping him to hunt.
Yeah, well, we'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. But when does Rockefeller get to go home? How's that going to work?
There's no reason to bring him back to his home in a couple days. They can go from state to state. They also have a new mate each year. And they're just these beautiful little gifts to us that are highly nocturnal, which is why we never get to see them.
Yeah. You know, this year has been so wild, so like awful, frankly. We all need a little bit of joy in our life. I hope, was this whole experience like as uplifting for you as it seems like it was in this difficult time?
Absolutely. The minute I saw him, I was encouraged because he had bright eyes. He was in the bottom of the box looking up at me. So with a clean bill of health, I'm thrilled to be able to share that with everyone because we all do need a wonderful Christmas story.
A little hope for us all. Ellen Kalish, director and founder of the Ravensbeard Wildlife Center in Saugerties, New York. Ellen, thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
And good luck to Rockefeller.
Thank you.
And the little bird will be set free this weekend. Here on the banks of the Colorado River in Yuma, Arizona, it's still warm enough in November for families to swim in the shallow water. At this point in its long journey, the once mighty Colorado is slowing down, and it will be reduced to a trickle by the time it reaches Mexico. The geography of this place is one of the reasons people love it here, including Yuma's mayor, Douglas Nichols.
I don't know if you have enough time to give everything that makes Yuma so great, but you know, we're located in the very southwest corner of the state of Arizona. So we border California, we border Mexico. We're a community of 105,000 people in the city, and we grow the world's lettuce during the winter season.
That's not an exaggeration. 90% of the country's winter lettuce comes from the fields around Yuma. And there's cotton, alfalfa, wheat, lemons. The river makes it possible. A carpet of irrigated green on the desert floor stretches almost uninterrupted for miles to President Trump's new border wall. That's the other thing to know about this place. Yuma County has more registered independents than any other party, and even though nearly 60% of the population is Latino, this is still Trump country.
Yes, I did support President Trump, yes.
President Trump likes to come here.
Yes.
Have you counted?
Yes. Twice only this year. Vice President came once on an unofficial visit this year, but we've had President Trump here three times since he became president, and the Vice President at least twice.
And it's because we're so close to the border. It's the wall that he loves to tout.
Joe Biden is the puppet of the radical left-wing movement that seeks the complete elimination of America's borders and boundaries. They want to take the wall down. They don't want to have borders. They want to have sanctuary cities. Lots of bad things.
That was President Trump at a rally here in August. He ended up losing Arizona, but Trump won Yuma County by more than 6 points. So, now what? Well, Joe Biden has promised to overturn many of President Trump's harsh immigration policies, and he said this to NPR back in August.
There will not be another foot of wall constructed in my administration.
But the Trump administration has already sunk up to $15 billion into it. And by the end of the year, the White House expects to have 450 miles of the towering 30-foot steel structure finished, almost all of it replacing smaller barriers that past presidents have put up.
The wall discussion is really interesting. And I think when you think about the wall, you have to think about a system and not just a vertical structure, but what is the security system that's put around that implementation. And so if we could wind back way before President Trump came in office in 2006, as a community, we had a very, very high peak of people coming across the border. And it was 1.5 times the size of our city was the volume of people that were coming our way. And what that did at the time is it redirected our police force to support all the ancillary efforts and issues that the Border Patrol couldn't take care of because of the sheer volume. Well, in 2007, President Bush did put up a fence of sorts, and that volume went from 148,000 to 8,000. So physical barriers are a real thing. They do have real capability. And right now, if you look across the southern border, we are, as a country, experiencing an extremely high peak of crossings, of people coming through, not through ports of entry, through other means. Yuma, with over 100 miles of secure border, is not experiencing that peak. We have about 30 cases a day, interdictions a day, which is more than manageable.
Well, I guess it does kind of prove the point, though, that the wall just forced them to go elsewhere. It's kind of irrelevant whether or not Donald Trump was good for the border because he's leaving office, right? I mean, and now you have a new Biden administration coming in. What are you thinking about that? Will that be a major shift for the area?
So we'll see. I mean, at this point, I'm not really sure what will be changing. I was also in office when President Obama was in office. We had very little interaction locally with the Obama administration officials. I've had a lot of interaction with the Trump officials, but I really hope the Biden administration doesn't really worry about the wall so much as it is how are we engaging with Mexico. What happens between the ports, neither country wants. Neither country wants it. What's happening at the ports, that's what both countries want to focus on.
In other words, commerce coming back and forth.
Well, it's commerce, it's tourism, it's trade, it's families. I mean, we have families that live on both sides of the border, and they regularly go home, visit people. There's a lot of things that happen that can only happen when we have a good functioning port system.
So that's the view from the mayor of Yuma.
¿Eh? ¿Vas o vienes?
No, voy llegando.
Oh, wow.
Popular around here?
He's actually one of my tenants.
Oh. 35 minutes to the south, I met the vice mayor of San Luis, Arizona, Matias Rosales. From this point near the San Luis port of entry, commercial produce trucks rumble by. Farm workers walk back to Mexico after a long day of work, and the sound of beating drums drifts over the international border.
We're right by the border. I mean, look at, here's the wall right in front of us.
Yes, sir.
What do you think of this thing?
It's always been here, but it's a new upgraded version of the wall.
It's a lot bigger than I remember the wall being.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I'm correct, they went up 20 feet more.
The city council is nonpartisan, but Rosales tends to vote for Democrats. He says he's looking forward to the end of the Trump administration's anti-immigrant rhetoric. But there is one thing he actually likes about the new wall. There's space between the slats that allow you to see through it.
To me, it's just an improvement aesthetically. It looks nicer, it's taller, but it still does the same purpose because someone can still jump this wall. People jump it no matter what height it is.
Do they really? Because they would get incredibly injured if they were to fall off that thing.
Have you seen the videos? They climb down with a rope and, I mean, they'll jump over.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of people think that this wall is really a symbol. I mean, it was a pet project of Donald Trump's, something to campaign on. What do you think?
I mean,
you live in this town.
It might be a symbol for him, but for us, it's normal because we've had it here. Now, if this was a new structure that we didn't have a wall before, then I might have a different opinion on that, but we've always had a wall here.
Yeah. In the waning days of the Trump administration, could you look back and tell me he was good for this region or not?
You know what? As a city council member, we've been pushing to get our new port of entry redesigned and redone. The Trump administration did provide us the funding, partial funding last year, so we were able to get $148 million for the port of entry. So in regards to improving the job environment and the security for our personnel, our customs, our homeland security officers, that is something that I think is more valuable than replacing a wall and just making it look nicer, because again, the wall was already here. Mm-hmm. So in regards to funding for the new building that we need desperately, that I think was a positive that he was able to do.
Was it all positive?
No, not all of it, no. Too much politics involved. If you're able to see the line, this commute right now, some of these people are waiting 4 or 5 hours to cross the border.
And you're pointing beyond the wall into Mexico. In other words, there's Mexican citizens trying to get into the United States just to go do everyday things here.
Well, not just Mexican citizens, American citizens. I mean, I went this morning twice. I have Sentry. I came in and went across within 5-10 minutes. Other people right now are going to be waiting 3-4 hours. And if someone wants to come and do their shopping here in San Luis, in Yuma, in our region, and if they got to wait 5 hours across the line, that's not going to bring our sales tax revenue to the community that we need desperately.
Is that situation worse under the Trump administration?
Yes, that is.
And why is that? Is that just because he's made it harder to get back and forth?
The long waits, correct. Yeah. Correct. And then right now, especially with the past 6-7 months with the COVID situation, our staff is not working at full-blown capacity. Right now, I believe there's only 3 lanes open when we have a total of 8 lanes available. So that's causing the delays also on the other side. Yeah.
And the semi-truck that's been rumbling behind us is now moving on out, so we'll let that pass.
Rosales says there's no way the wall was worth the money. Environmental groups despise it for spoiling pristine aquifers. Native groups say construction has desecrated sacred lands. But what should the president-elect do about it? That is more complicated.
So why would Biden come in and tear down a wall that all our tax dollars paid for? It's already here. I mean, I'd rather see them give us the money for the port of entry and the employees that we need for our port of entry than spending money on a wall. Because there's, I mean, how many tunnels don't they find? I mean, people still jump over the walls. That's not really doing what they're promising that needs to be done. It's an idea, but it's not a reality.
On cue, the music stops.
Someone, you have to go give that guy a dollar over there. You know? Yeah, so.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Matias Rosales, the vice mayor of San Luis, Arizona. We'll hear more from the border in the days ahead, including a visit to a lettuce field to see how Yuma's farm workers are staying safe in the pandemic.
We want to mark a sports milestone today, and that is the first woman to fill the general manager's role in Major League Baseball. Kim Eng is the new general manager of the Miami Marlins, and during a socially distanced press conference held on Zoom earlier this week, she said she wants her story to be an inspiration.
You know, girls can see it. I mean, there's an adage, you know, you can't be it if you can't see it. But I guess I would suggest to them now you can see it.
Mike Pesca is a sports analyst for Here and Now, and he hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, Kim Eng started her baseball career as an intern. Now she's in charge of a team. Your thoughts on what this means for baseball and inclusion?
Well, it's absolutely a milestone, and it was late in coming. And that's an important point to make. Meg Rowley, who is a baseball writer and hosts the Effectively Wild podcast, you know, as a woman in baseball, she's a journalist, she's heartened by it, but it did take so long. And Kim Eng is so qualified to the point where a male of her qualifications, I think this can be said without controversy, would certainly have been hired by now. So that's not a reason maybe to get depressed. It is the first of a change. Like I said, eminently qualified. And if you even listen to some of the interviews that Kim Eng did, you get the feeling, because she's talking about her attempts to be a GM in the past tense in some of these interviews, you get the feeling that maybe she even gave up on this dream, but it is happening. And now if you want to trade with the Marlins, she's the one to talk to.
Mm-hmm. There's something else I want to talk to you about regarding representation. The National Football League has assembled an all-black officiating crew for the first time in the league's history for Monday night's game. Tell us about that.
I'll read a quote from the NFL. This historic Week 11 crew is a testament to the countless and immeasurable contributions of black officials to the game, their exemplary performance, and the power of inclusion that is the hallmark of this great game. So it is true that the NFL has 4 of its 17 crew chiefs who are black, which is a higher percentage than black coaches in the NFL. Now, normally this wouldn't happen because crews are set in the beginning of the year and they're diverse. They're mostly diverse and you wouldn't get an all black crew. But this year, because of COVID, they're going to more of a geographic basis. This gave them the opportunity to do this. They wanted to make this point, and it is another milestone, as you say, for inclusion and diversity.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about this intensive protocol for COVID-19? The NFL also said this week that it's placing all teams in these intensive protocols. What does that exactly mean?
Right. Yeah, it's more masking and it's meals that aren't in, you know, group settings. And I do have to say, it's one of those things where you would say, oh, it's good that they're going to this more intensive protocol. But then you stop and say, wait, why didn't they do this beforehand? You have masses of people. NFL teams, including staffs, are well over 100 people. Why wasn't everyone masking indoors to begin with? Well, whatever the reason was, they did at least look at the stats and decide to change and to get a little more strict. And the statistics show that the teams that have used a more intensive protocol have had fewer cases of COVID. I make this point often, every week as we talk, you know, sports are like America and society. There's no reason why this wouldn't be true.
Absolutely. Well, I want to ask you about something else. Congress stepped into sports this week. The Senate passed a bill that will allow U.S. officials to prosecute anyone involved in doping at international sporting events. I mean, everybody wants clean competition and punishment for athletes who use performance-enhancing drugs. But how will this law be enforced?
So the idea behind this law, which sailed through Congress and is expected to be signed by Donald Trump, is that it will target conspiracies, massive conspiracies, not the individual doper. And of course, the United States, there is the long arm of the law that extends to other countries. A lot of the FIFA soccer scandals were uncovered by FBI investigations. But this law, which is called the Rodchenkov Law, and it's named after Grigory Rodchenkov, who is the whistleblower in Sochi, and he was the subject of the Oscar-winning documentary Icarus, it's not without controversy. WADA, which is the World Anti-Doping Agency, although they are earnestly against doping, they're against this law because they feel it muddies, well, who has jurisdiction, who is going to be making these prosecutions. But Travis Tygart, who is the American representative of WADA, he says this law is needed. So I think, I don't know if it will actually be put into effect. I don't know if we'll see actual U.S. prosecutions going after Russian doping, but at least, you know, it is a statement.
Yeah. Mike, I have less than a minute with you, so I want to go to the NBA. They held its annual players draft last night. Did anything jump out at you? And what's the plan for this coming season?
I think they'll start the season maybe in late December or in January, play fewer games than usual. And LaMelo Ball, who is a famous Ball brother, he went number three, two brothers taken in the top five. That's notable. Horribly, the Golden State Warriors, Klay Thompson, suffered a re-injury, so that sets back the Warriors. That kind of overshadowed their part of the draft.
Oh, wow. One last thing. March Madness, a March Madness bubble for college basketball players. That's something that we're looking to.
Yeah. One town, all the games.
One town, all the games. We'll talk about that more the next time we talk to you. Mike Pesca is here and now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. As always, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.